The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it, we can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. So good morning, and for anyone who may not know me, I'm Reverend Margaret. I found out, it's not really my turn to give a talk today, and I found out, I think, about Tuesday that I was going to be giving this talk. So please forgive me if I'm a little stumbly at times. Not long ago, someone asked me what was my favorite scripture, and I drew a blank. I just didn't know. Mental function isn't as quick and sharp as it might have been some time ago. But today I could say it was Great Master Dogen's Rules for Meditation. And I'd like to begin with a line from that scripture. At one time I was asked to write out a line of scripture that was vital to me, and it was this one. Think of neither good nor evil. Consider neither right nor wrong. Now, at this time in my training, what this suggests is letting go of habitual, judgmental, critical thoughts and emotions. So what do we do instead? We meditate. We keep the precepts. We work from the heart or Buddha nature and rely on wise discernment. We return again and again to what Reverend Master Jiyu called the third position, that which is beyond the opposites. Opposites such as right and wrong, good and evil. Today I'll be talking about training with views, judgmental mind, and criticism. I wonder if any of you have any strong views, or ever find yourselves making judgments and believing them, criticizing yourself or others? And is there any satisfaction or comfort in these attitudes? So that's what we can consider. Here at the Abbey, every morning after meditation, we have morning service. And by the way, it's always cheering to have people join us for that. It's a helpful way to start the day. We make bows, offer incense, and then chant the Heart Sutra, or Scripture of Great Wisdom. And here's how it begins. When one with deepest wisdom of the heart, that is beyond discriminative thought, great Bodhisattva Kanzeon knew that the five skandhas were void, unstained, and pure. In other words, he or she realized something about emptiness, which I'm going to leave alone. Instead, I'll highlight some of the key words from those lines. Deepest wisdom of the heart that is beyond discriminative thought, and great Kanzeon Bodhisattva knew. I'll leave it dangling right there with that verb, knew. The great Bodhisattva knew something that was true in the most profound sense of the word. When one with deepest wisdom of the heart, what that suggests is that Kanzeon Bodhisattva was deep in meditation, united with the source of great wisdom. He was one with that source, true to that source, as an unsullied stream is clear. To quote another of our morning service scriptures. The heart here is not what I call the Valentine heart, or seat of sentimentality. And let me refer you to last week's talk by Reverend Master Daishin about the mind and heart. I'm talking about the Buddha nature inherent in each and every one of us. Adolf Hitler, Mother Teresa, and His Holiness the Dalai Lama, clear on through to you and me. This is the heart of great wisdom, And we take refuge in it. And when we take refuge in it, then we can truly know. And we begin to take refuge in it when we're willing to leave our views, judgments, and opinions aside. Cut all ties. Give up everything. Sounds great. And it ain't easy. It takes a lot of practice and a lot of patience. And just when we might think, oh, now I've got it, boom, there it is again. Our views, judgments, and opinions are strongly conditioned, and we need the practice of patience in training with them. Now I'm going to introduce a story from the Pali Canon, the first written teachings of the Buddha, called, and please pardon my pronunciation, the Kokunada Sutta. It's a story about views. The story's central figure is the Venerable Ananda, the Buddha's longtime attendant and one of his closest disciples. One day, having stopped to bathe, Ananda encounters a wanderer named Kokunada, who asks him what he is. When Ananda replies that he's a monk and a follower of the Buddha, Kokunada politely inquires whether he might pose a question. And Ananda replies, "Go ahead and ask. Having heard your question, I'll inform you." So Kokunada says, "How is it, my friend? The cosmos is eternal. Only this is true. Everything else is worthless. Is this the sort of view you have?" Ananda answers, "No, my friend, I don't have that sort of view." "Very well, then," says Kokunada, "the cosmos is not eternal. Only this is true. Anything else is worthless. Is this the sort of view you have?" Ananda answers, "No, my friend, I don't have that sort of view." Kokunada then comes up with another question, and another, a whole string of questions. Is the cosmos finite? Is it infinite? Are the soul and body the same? Is the soul one thing and the body another? After death, a Tathagata, or a Buddha, exists. After death, a Tathagata does not exist. After death, a Tathagata both does and does not exist. After death, a Tathagata neither does nor does not exist. And each question he follows with, "Only this is true. Anything else is worthless. Is this the sort of view you have?" He wants a definitive answer, and Ananda's answer is always the same. "No, my friend, I don't have that sort of view." Kokunada then asks Ananda, and I can imagine now a bit of frustration here, "Then in that case, do you not know or see?" And Ananda finally gives him a definitive answer. "I do know. I do see." By this time, I imagine, Kokunada might have been thoroughly baffled. He goes on to ask Ananda, after running through the list of questions and answers once again, "Now, how is the meaning of this statement, 'I do know, I do see,' to be understood?" Ananda replies, "The cosmos is eternal. Only this is true. Anything else is worthless," is a viewpoint. Ananda runs through the whole list again, declaring each question to be a viewpoint, or each position. He then goes on to say, "The extent to which there are viewpoints, view stances, the taking up of views, obsessions with views, the cause of views, and the uprooting of views, that's what I know. That's what I see. Knowing that, I say, I know. Seeing that, I say, I see. Why should I say, I don't know, I don't see? I do know, I do see." Ananda knows with deepest wisdom of the heart the nature of views and our attachment to them. Here's something from Bhikkhu Bodhi about views. Views flow out and interlock with the practical dimension of our lives at many levels. They determine our values. They give birth to our goals and aspirations. They guide our choices in morally difficult dilemmas. So say I'm the leader of a strong nation, and I hold the view that a certain territory really belongs to my nation and not another. And so I choose to resolve the dispute about this by means of warfare. Conviction of the absolute truth of my view, that this territory is ours, justifies in my mind, as that leader, the taking of an action that may cause great harm. There's no problem in having views when we follow Ananda's wisdom in knowing them as views rather than trying to make reality conform to them. We all have views, so what's the problem? A view is, to quote the dictionary, an opinion or judgment colored by the feeling or bias of its holder. This feeling or bias can put our views well out of line with reality and thus make them a hindrance in our Buddhist practice. Here's another example, one that actually happens in daily life. Say a decision is made in the monastery, and imagine I don't agree with that decision. In fact, I may hold the view that it's wrong, because its consequences could possibly be harmful to myself and others. My first reaction on hearing about it might be the emotion of anger. Then, fueled by anger, I may start thinking, that decision is crazy. It's insane. From there, I have some choices. I can persist in criticizing the decision and the person who made it. I can even go to that person and try to use verbal force to argue them into changing it. Another choice would be to recognize the anger at the heart of my response and to follow the precept by letting go of that anger. Let it go. Let it go. Not once, but many times. Then I can let go of my view of the situation and the judgmental and critical thoughts fueled by the anger. Let them go. Not once, but many times. Now, please indulge me, if you will, with a linguistic digression. Recently, I was reading the biography of the great Thai forest master Ajahn Chah, describing how he taught his Western disciples at a time when he knew no English, nor did his disciples know the Thai language. He relied on a couple of pithy phrases, one of which was, and again pardon my pronunciation, ploy wang, let it go, in English. That's close to being all we need, isn't it? Having let go of anger, judgment, and criticism, the mind of the offended monk in the example might now be clear enough to decide just to let it go and happen as it will and do the best we can with it. After all, I could be wrong. Or, if it seems good, in the third position beyond good and evil, I might realize that I'm not seeing the whole picture and might inquire about the reasons for thinking it's a good idea. Perhaps I could learn something. One thing that helps in letting go of judgmental thoughts and criticism is to take a bigger perspective. In a fine article called Judging and Criticizing, which is available on the Berkeley Buddhist Priory website, Reverend Master Kinray Basis says, we can view our opinions as being reality and believe in that truth. But all opinions are based on only a partial view, and we can never know everything. This means that we can never know when we will see something that we were previously unaware of. This new insight can completely change the way we view and judge something. And there's the famous folk story on this theme of the blind men and the elephant, which you've probably all heard when a group of blind men are brought to see to experience an elephant and describe it. Each one touches a different part of the elephant. One touches the tail, for example, and says, "It's like a snake," and so on. Imagine the surprise they might experience if they suddenly had their sight and could see what the elephant actually looked like. It would be quite different from any of its parts. Someone I read, and I forget who, described what they called the cosmic perspective. In the context of a great universe, how important is this thing, whether I'm right or wrong, whether I get my way, etc.? And this is one thing I always recall when I take time of an evening to stop outdoors and gaze at the sky. How vast it is and how small are my concerns. Going on a bit with Reverend Master Kinray's article, he says that whenever we are certain of our opinions or judgments, we can still be wrong. It does not mean we ignore the judgmental mind. It means we should not let that faculty of judging and discriminating dominate us. We want to approach everything in our life with an open mind that recognizes that we could be wrong. The mind of Buddhist training is not obsessed with being right or being perfect, as the human mind can sometimes be. And I'll give you an example of my own. One evening, not too long ago, I made an announcement to the monks and the lay guests, something like, "Breakfast tomorrow will be at 9 o'clock. And immediately another monk spoke up to say, "No, it's at 9:15. The joyful moment for me came when I recognized my initial response of shame-induced anger. The meal was indeed at 9:15, and I let it go. That was wonderful. One of the most helpful teachings I received from Reverend Master Jiyu was, I could be wrong. And another was, the universe isn't answerable to my personal will. Knowing I could be wrong and that I'm not in charge of the universe are infinitely liberating when I let those teachings do their work. Continuing a bit with Reverend Master Kinray's article, one way of viewing meditation and mindfulness practice is that we are allowing our minds and hearts to stay in touch with a sense of stillness, silence, and spaciousness, and not allowing our judgments and opinions to dominate and fill us. We want to view everything with equanimity and peace. It is good to notice, he says, how our hard judgments and strong opinions lead to a sense of conflict and a rejection of what we are facing in our life. And I think I might add the word attachment to our hard judgments and strong opinions, or clinging to our hard judgments and strong opinions are the problem that cause the suffering. It's the attachment and the clinging. My experience is that the more we do our practice, the more that sense of stillness, silence, and spaciousness becomes available to us. This can even happen over the span of one meditation period. At the beginning, there may be a tune going through my head, together with a movie review and a list of the things I need to do after the meditation period, and I can recall a pleasant or unpleasant event that happened, either lately or in the far past, and the list would be very long, it could be. Then I notice by the end of the meditation period, the song has faded away. The list sits quietly to one side until the time comes to tend to it, and the movie review and the memories are gone. Don't get me wrong, this is not a blank mind that we're aiming at in meditating. Thoughts, songs, memories, and so on continue to come along, and we continue to let them go. As the late Japanese Zen master Uchiyama Roshi put it, the mind's job is to secrete thoughts. For you and me, our job is neither grasping them nor pushing them away. Just sitting with no deliberate thought, just letting them pass through, letting them go, ploy wang. Pleasant or unpleasant experiences may arise, or thoughts that this is a good or a bad meditation. Ploy wang, let it go. Of course, there are times when we need to make decisions. We may even find ourselves in the position of that person who makes the unpopular or questionable decision. So, what do we use if not the judgmental mind? The more we practice meditation, precepts, and attentive awareness, the more often wise discernment becomes available to us. Watching our mind allows us to see various opposing choices from which we might feel obliged to choose one or the other, such as, is the cosmos eternal or is the cosmos not eternal? And we can look at them from the third position. When the opposites arise, says the Rules for Meditation scripture, you have almost lost the way to salvation. I love that almost in there. The mind of meditation, the precepts, they're always available to us, and we can always get back on the path. There's no eternal damnation in Buddhism. So I'm going to end here with another quote from the Rules for Meditation scripture. It concludes by saying, if you do these things, that is your meditation practice, if you do these things for some time, you will become as herein described, and then the treasure house will open naturally, and you will enjoy it fully. And the conclusion of the scripture of great wisdom, O Buddha, going, going, going on beyond, and always going on beyond, always becoming Buddha. So let's go do it. Thank you. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha.